organizer of private gaiety, curator of a richly encrusted happiness. His hat was a perfect hat, and he carried a heavy stick and yellow gloves. She thought what a good time they would all have being with him tonight. They walked upstairs, 5 flights. At the first landing, they stopped and kissed. She was careful on the next landing. On the 3rd, more careful still. On the next, there were 2 more. She stopped halfway and kissed him fleetingly goodbye. At his urgency, she walked down with him to the one below for a minute, and then up and up. Finally, it was goodbye with their hands stretching to touch along the diagonal of the banister, and then the fingers slipping apart. Dick went back downstairs to make some arrangements for the evening. Rosemary ran to her room and wrote a letter to her mother. She was conscience-stricken, because she did not miss her mother at all. Chapter 18. Although the divers were honestly apathetic to organized fashion, they were nevertheless too acute to abandon its contemporaneous rhythm and beat. Dick's parties were all concerned with excitement, and a chance breath of fresh night air was the more precious for being experienced in the intervals of the excitement. The party that night moved with the speed of a slapstick comedy. They were 12. They were 16. They were quartets and separate motors bound on a quick odyssey over Paris. Everything had been foreseen. People joined them as if by magic, accompanied them as specialists, almost guides, through a phase of the evening, dropped out, and were succeeded by other people, so that it appeared as if the freshness of each one had been husbanded for them all day. Rosemary appreciated how different it was from any party in Hollywood, no matter how splendid in scale. There was, among many diversions, the car of the Shah of Persia. Where Dick had commandeered this vehicle, what bribery was employed, these were facts of irrelevance. Rosemary accepted it as merely a new facet of the fabulous, which for 2 years had filled her life. The car had been built on a special chassis in America. Its wheels were of silver, so was the radiator. The inside of the body was inlaid with innumerable brilliants, which would be replaced with true gems by the court jeweler when the car arrived in Tehran the following week. There was only one real seat in back, because the Shah must ride alone. So they took turns riding in it and sitting on the marten fur that covered the floor. But always there was Dick. Rosemary assured the image of her mother, ever carried with her, that never, never had she known anyone so nice, so thoroughly nice as Dick was that night. She compared him with the 2 Englishmen, whom Abe addressed conscientiously as Major Hengist and Mr. Horsa, and with the heir to a Scandinavian throne and the novelist just back from Russia, and with Abe, who was desperate and witty, and with Collis Clay, who joined them somewhere and stayed along, and felt there was no comparison. The enthusiasm, the selflessness behind the whole performance ravished her. The technique of moving many varied types, each as immobile, as dependent on supplies of attention as an infantry battalion is dependent on rations, appeared so effortless that he still had pieces of his own most personal self for everyone. Afterward, she remembered the times when she had felt the happiest. The first time was when she and Dick danced together, and she felt her beauty sparkling bright against his tall, strong form as they floated, hovering like people in an amusing dream. He turned her here and there with such a delicacy of suggestion that she was like a bright bouquet, a piece of precious cloth being displayed before 50 eyes. There was a moment when they were not dancing at all, simply clinging together. Sometime in the early morning they were alone, and her damp, powdery young body came up close to him in a crush of tired cloth, and stayed there, crushed against a background of other people's hats and wraps. The time she laughed most was later, when 6 of them, the best of them, noblest relics of the evening, stood in the dusky front lobby of the Ritz, telling the night concierge that General Pershing was outside and wanted caviar and champagne.
He brooks no delay. Every man, every gun is at his service.
Frantic waiters emerged from nowhere. A table was set in the lobby, and Abe came in, representing General Pershing, while they stood up and mumbled remembered fragments of war songs at him. In the waiters' injured reaction to this anticlimax, they found themselves neglected. So they built a waiter trap, a huge and fantastic device constructed of all the furniture in the lobby and functioning like one of the bizarre machines of a Goldberg cartoon. Abe shook his head doubtfully at it.
Perhaps it would be better to steal a musical saw and...
That's enough, Mary interrupted. When Abe begins bringing up that, it's time to go home. Anxiously, she confided to Rosemary. I've got to get Abe home. His boat train leaves at 11. It's so important. I feel the whole future depends on his catching it. But whenever I argue with him, he does the exact opposite. I'll try and persuade him, offered Rosemary.
Would you?
Mary said doubtfully.
Maybe you could.
Then Dick came up to Rosemary.
Nicole and I are going home, and we thought you'd want to go with us.
Her face was pale with fatigue in the false dawn. Two wan dark spots in her cheek marked where the color was by day.
I can't, she said. I promised Mary North to stay along with them, or Abe will never go to bed. Maybe you could do something.
Don't you know you can't do anything about people? He advised her. If Abe was my roommate in college, tight for the first time, it'd be different.
Now there's nothing to do. Well, I've got to stay. He says he'll go to bed if we only come to the Isle with him,
she said, almost defiantly. He kissed the inside of her elbow quickly.
Don't let Rosemary go home alone, Nicole called to Mary as they left. We feel responsible to her mother.
Later, Rosemary and the Norths, and a manufacturer of dolls' voices from Newark, and ubiquitous Collis, and a big, splendidly dressed oil Indian named George T. Horse Protection, were riding along on top of thousands of carrots in a market wagon. The earth in the carrot beards was fragrant and sweet in the darkness, and Rosemary was so high up in the load that she could hardly see the others in the long shadow between infrequent street lamps. Their voices came from far off, as if they were having experiences different from hers, different and far away, for she was with Dick in her heart. Sorry she had come with the Norths, wishing she was at the hotel and him asleep across the hall, or that he was here, beside her, with the warm darkness streaming down.
"Don't come up," she called to Collis. "The carrots will all roll."
She threw one at Abe, who was sitting beside the driver, stiffly like an old man. Later, she was homeward bound at last, in broad daylight, with the pigeons already breaking over Saint-Sulpice. All of them began to laugh spontaneously because they knew it was still last night, while the people in the streets had the delusion that it was bright hot morning.
"At last, I've been on a wild party," thought Rosemary. "But it's no fun when Dick isn't there."
She felt a little betrayed and sad. But presently, a moving object came into sight. It was a huge horse chestnut tree in full bloom, bound for the Champs-Élysées, strapped now into a long truck, and simply shaking with laughter, like a lovely person in an undignified position, yet confident nonetheless of being lovely. Looking at it with fascination, Rosemary identified herself with it and laughed cheerfully with it. And everything, all at once, seemed gorgeous.
Chapter 19. Abe left from the Gare Saint-Lazare at 11. He stood alone under the fouled glass dome, relic of the 70s, era of the Crystal Palace. His hands, of that vague gray color that only 24 hours can produce, were in his coat pockets to conceal the trembling fingers. With his hat removed, it was plain that only the top layer of his hair was brushed back. The lower levels were pointed resolutely sidewise.
He was scarcely recognizable as the man who had swum upon Ghost's Beach a fortnight ago. He was early. He looked from left to right with his eyes only. It would have taken nervous forces out of his control to use any other part of his body. New-looking baggage went past him. Presently, prospective passengers, with dark little bodies, were calling, "Jewels! Hoo!" in dark, piercing voices. At the minute when he wondered whether or not he had time for a drink at the buffet, and began clutching at the soggy wad of 1,000-franc notes in his pocket, one end of his pendulous glance came to rest upon the apparition of Nicole at the stairhead. He watched her. She was self-revelatory in her little expressions, as people seemed to someone waiting for them, who as yet is himself unobserved. She was frowning, thinking of her children, less gloating over them than merely animally counting them, a cat checking her cubs with a paw. When she saw Abe, the mood passed out of her face. The glow of the morning skylight was sad, and Abe made a gloomy figure with dark circles that showed through the crimson tan under his eyes. They sat down on a bench. "I came because you asked me," said Nicole defensively. Abe seemed to have forgotten why he asked her, and Nicole was quite content to look at the travelers passing by. "That's going to be the belle of your boat. That one with all the men to say goodbye. You see why she bought that dress." Nicole talked faster and faster. "You see why nobody else would buy it except the belle of the world cruise? See? No? Wake up! That's a story dress. That extra material tells a story, and somebody on world cruise would be lonesome enough to want to hear it." She bit close her last words. She had talked too much for her, and Abe found it difficult to gather from her serious set face that she had spoken at all. With an effort, he drew himself up to a posture that looked as if he were standing up while he was sitting down. "The afternoon, you took me to that funny ball, you know, St. Genevieve's," he began. "I remember. It was fun, wasn't it?" "No fun for me. I haven't had fun seeing you this time. I'm tired of you both, but it doesn't show because you're even more tired of me. You know what I mean. If I had any enthusiasm, I'd go on to new people." There was a rough nap on Nicole's velvet gloves as she slapped him back. "Seems rather foolish to be unpleasant, Abe." "Anyhow, you don't mean that. I can't see why you've given up about everything." Abe considered, trying hard not to cough or blow his nose. "I suppose I got bored, and then it was such a long way to go back in order to get anywhere." Often a man can play the helpless child in front of a woman, but he can almost never bring it off when he feels most like a helpless child. "No excuse for it," Nicole said crisply. Abe was feeling worse every minute. He could think of nothing but disagreeable and sheerly nervous remarks. Nicole thought that the correct attitude for her was to sit staring straight ahead, hands in her lap. For a while, there was no communication between them. Each was racing away from the other, breathing only insofar as there was blue space ahead, a sky not seen by the other. Unlike lovers, they possessed no past. Unlike man and wife, they possessed no future. Yet up to this morning, Nicole had liked Abe better than anyone except Dick, and he had been heavy, belly-frightened with love for her for years.
"Tired of women's worlds,"
he spoke up suddenly. "Then why don't you make a world of your own?"
"Tired of friends. The thing is to have sycophants."
Nicole tried to force the minute hand around on the station clock, but...
"You agree?"
he demanded. "I am a woman, and my business is to hold things together."
"My business is to tear them apart."
"When you get drunk, you don't tear anything apart except yourself," she said. Cold now, and frightened, and unconfident. The station was filling, but no one she knew came. After a moment, her eyes fell gratefully on a tall girl with straw hair like a helmet, who was dropping letters in the mail slot. "A girl I have to speak to, Abe."
"Abe, wake up! You fool!"
Patiently, Abe followed her with his eyes.
The woman turned in a startled way to greet Nicole, and Abe recognized her as someone he had seen around Paris. He took advantage of Nicole's absence to cough hard and retchingly into his handkerchief and to blow his nose loud. The morning was warmer, and his underwear was soaked with sweat. His fingers trembled so violently that it took 4 matches to light a cigarette. It seemed absolutely necessary to make his way into the buffet for a drink, but immediately Nicole returned. "That was a mistake," she said with frosty humor. "After begging me to come and see her, she gave me a good snubbing. She looked at me as if I were rotted." Excited, she did a little laugh, as with 2 fingers high in the scales. "Let people come to you." Abe recovered from a cigarette cough and remarked,
"Trouble is, when you're sober, you don't want to see anybody. And when you're tight, nobody wants to see you."
"Who, me?" Nicole laughed again. For some reason, the late encounter had cheered her.
"No, me."
"Speak for yourself. I like people. A lot of people. I like..." Rosemary and Mary North came in sight, walking slowly and searching for Abe. And Nicole burst forth grossly with, "Hey! Hi! Hey!" and laughed and waved the package of handkerchiefs she had bought for Abe. They stood in an uncomfortable little group, weighted down by Abe's gigantic presence. He lay athwart them like the wreck of a galleon, dominating with his presence his own weakness and self-indulgence, his narrowness and bitterness. All of them were conscious of the solemn dignity that flowed from him, of his achievement, fragmentary, suggestive, and surpassed. But they were frightened at his survivant will. Once a will to live, now become a will to die. Dick Diver came and brought with him a fine glowing surface on which the 3 women sprang like monkeys with cries of relief, perching on his shoulders, on the beautiful crown of his hat, or the gold head of his cane. Now, for a moment, they could disregard the spectacle of Abe's gigantic obscenity. Dick saw the situation quickly and grasped it quietly. He pulled them out of themselves into the station, making plain its wonders. Nearby, some Americans were saying goodbye in voices that mimicked the cadence of water running into a large old bathtub. Standing in the station, with Paris in back of them, it seemed as if they were vicariously leaning a little over the ocean, already undergoing a sea change, a shifting about of atoms to form the essential molecule of a new people. So the well-to-do Americans poured through the station onto the platforms with frank new faces, intelligent, considerate, thoughtless, thought-for. An occasional English face among them seemed sharp and emergent. When there were enough Americans on the platform, the first impression of their immaculacy and their money began to fade into a vague racial dusk that hindered and blinded both them and their observers. Nicole seized Dick's arm, crying, "Look!" Dick turned in time to see what took place in half a minute. At a Pullman entrance, 2 cars off, a vivid scene detached itself from the tenor of many farewells. The young woman with the helmet-like hair to whom Nicole had spoken made an odd, dodging little run away from the man to whom she was talking and plunged a frantic hand into her purse. Then the sound of 2 revolver shots cracked the narrow air of the platform. Simultaneously, the engine whistled sharply, and the train began to move, momentarily dwarfing the shots in significance. Abe waved again from his window, oblivious to what had happened. But before the crowd closed in, the others had seen the shots take effect, seen the target sit down upon the platform. Only after 100 years did the train stop. Nicole, Mary, and Rosemary waited on the outskirts, while Dick fought his way through. It was 5 minutes before he found them again. By this time, the crowd had split into 2 sections, following, respectively, the man on a stretcher and the girl walking pale and firm between distraught gendarmes. "It was Maria Wallace," Dick said hurriedly. "The man she shot was an Englishman. They had an awful time finding out who, because she shot him through his identification card." They were walking quickly from the train, swayed along with the crowd. "I found out what post of police they're taking her to, so I'll go there."
"But her sister lives in Paris," Nicole objected. "Why not phone her?
Seems very peculiar. Nobody thought of that. She's married to a Frenchman, and he can do more than we can.
Dick hesitated, shook his head, and started off.
Wait! Nicole cried after him. That's foolish! How can you do any good with your French?
At least I'll see they don't do anything outrageous to her.
They're certainly going to hold on to her, Nicole assured him briskly. She did shoot the man. The best thing is to phone right away to Laura. She can do more than we can.
Dick was unconvinced. Also, he was showing off for Rosemary.
You wait, said Nicole firmly, and hurried off to a telephone booth.
When Nicole takes things into her hands, he said with affectionate irony, there is nothing more to be done.
He saw Rosemary for the first time that morning. They exchanged glances, trying to recognize the emotions of the day before. For a moment, each seemed unreal to the other. Then the slow, warm hum of love began again.
You like to help everybody, don't you?
Rosemary said.
I only pretend to.
Mother likes to help everybody. Of course, she can't help as many people as you do.
She sighed.
Sometimes I think I'm the most selfish person in the world.
For the first time, the mention of her mother annoyed rather than amused Dick. He wanted to sweep away her mother, remove the whole affair from the nursery footing upon which Rosemary persistently established it. But he realized that this impulse was a loss of control. What would become of Rosemary's urge toward him if, for even a moment, he relaxed? He saw, not without panic, that the affair was sliding to rest. It could not stand still. It must go on or go back. For the first time, it occurred to him that Rosemary had her hand on the lever more authoritatively than he. Before he had thought out a course of procedure, Nicole returned.
I found Laura. It was the first news she had, and her voice kept fading away and then getting loud again, as if she was fainting and then pulling herself together. She said she knew something was going to happen this morning.
Maria ought to be with Diaghilev,
said Dick in a gentle tone in order to bring them back to quietude.
She has a nice sense of decor, not to say rhythm. Will any of us ever see a train pulling out without hearing a few shots?
They bumped down the wide steel steps.
I'm sorry for the poor man, Nicole said.
Of course, that's why she talked so strange to me. She was getting ready to open fire.
She laughed. Rosemary laughed, too. But they were both horrified, and both of them deeply wanted Dick to make a moral comment on the matter and not leave it to them. This wish was not entirely conscious, especially on the part of Rosemary, who was accustomed to having shell fragments of such events shriek past her head. But a totality of shock had piled up in her, too. For the moment, Dick was too shaken by the impetus of his newly recognized emotion to resolve things into the pattern of the holiday. So the women, missing something, lapsed into a vague unhappiness. Then, as if nothing had happened, the lives of the divers and their friends flowed out into the street. However, everything had happened. Abe's departure and Mary's impending departure for Salzburg this afternoon had ended the time in Paris. Or perhaps the shots, the concussions that had finished God knew what dark matter, had terminated it. The shots had entered into all their lives. Echoes of violence followed them out onto the pavement where two porters held a post-mortem beside them as they waited for a taxi.
Tu as vu le revolver? Il était très petit, très belle, on jouait.
Mais assez puissant,
said the other porter sagely.
Tu as vu sa chemise?
Assez de sang pour se croire à la guerre.
Chapter 20. In the square, as they came out, a suspended mass of gasoline exhaust cooked slowly in the July sun. It was a terrible thing. Unlike pure heat, it held no promise of rural escape, but suggested only roads choked with the same foul asthma. During their luncheon, outdoors, across from the Luxembourg Gardens, Rosemary had cramps and felt fretful and full of impatient lassitude. It was the foretaste of this that had inspired her self-accusation of selfishness in the station. Dick had no suspicion of the sharpness of the change.
He was profoundly unhappy, and the subsequent increase of egotism tended momentarily to blind him to what was going on round about him, and deprive him of the long groundswell of imagination that he counted on for his judgments. After Mary North left them, accompanied by the Italian singing teacher who had joined them for coffee and was taking her to her train, Rosemary, too, stood up, bound for an engagement at her studio.
"Meet some officials."
"And oh," she proposed,
"if Collis Clay, that southern boy, if he comes while you are still sitting here, just tell him I couldn't wait. Tell him to call me tomorrow."
Too insouciant. In reaction from the late disturbance, she had assumed the privileges of a child, the result being to remind the divers of their exclusive love for their own children. Rosemary was sharply rebuked in a short passage between the women. "You'd better leave the message with a waiter." Nicole's voice was stern and unmodulated. "We're leaving immediately." Rosemary got it, took it without resentment.
"I'll let it go, then. Goodbye, you darlings."
Dick asked for the check. The divers relaxed, chewing tentatively on toothpicks. "Well," they said together. He saw a flash of unhappiness on her mouth, so brief that only he would have noticed, and he could pretend not to have seen. What did Nicole think? Rosemary was one of a dozen people he had worked over in the past years. These had included a French circus clown, Abe and Mary North, a pair of dancers, a writer, a painter, a comedienne from the Grand Guignol, a half-crazy pederast from the Russian ballet, a promising tenor they had staked to a year in Milan. Nicole well knew how seriously these people interpreted his interest and enthusiasm. But she realized also that, except while their children were being born, Dick had not spent a night apart from her since their marriage. On the other hand, there was a pleasingness about him that simply had to be used. Those who possessed that pleasingness had to keep their hands in and go along attaching people that they had no use to make of. Now Dick hardened himself and let minutes pass without making any gesture of confidence, any representation of constantly renewed surprise that they were one together. Collis Clay, out of the south, edged a passage between the closely packed tables and greeted the divers cavalierly. Such salutations always astonished Dick. Acquaintances saying, "Hi," to them, or speaking only to one of them. He felt so intensely about people that in moments of apathy he preferred to remain concealed. That one could parade a casualness into his presence was a challenge to the key on which he lived. Collis, unaware that he was without a wedding garment, heralded his arrival with, "I reckon I'm late. The bait has flown." Dick had to wrench something out of himself before he could forgive him for not having first complimented Nicole. She left almost immediately, and he sat with Collis, finishing the last of his wine. He rather liked Collis. He was post-war, less difficult than most of the southerners he had known at New Haven a decade previously. Dick listened with amusement to the conversation that accompanied the slow, profound stuffing of a pipe. In the early afternoon, children and nurses were trekking into the Luxembourg Gardens. It was the first time in months that Dick had let this part of the day out of his hands. Suddenly, his blood ran cold as he realized the content of Collis's confidential monologue.
"She's not so cold as you'd probably think. I admit I thought she was cold for a long time. But she got into a jam with a friend of mine going from New York to Chicago at Easter. A boy named Hillis she thought was pretty nutsy at New Haven. She had a compartment with a cousin of mine, but she and Hillis wanted to be alone. So in the afternoon, my cousin came and played cards in our compartment. Well, after about 2 hours, we went back, and there was Rosemary and Bill Hillis, standing in the vestibule, arguing with the conductor. Rosemary white as a sheet. Seems they locked the door and pulled down the blinds. And I guess there was some heavy stuff going on when the conductor came for the tickets and knocked on the door. They thought it was us kidding them and wouldn't let him in at first. And when they did, he was plenty sore. He asked Hillis if that was his compartment and whether he and Rosemary were married, that they locked the door. and Hillis lost his temper, trying to explain there was nothing wrong. He said the conductor had insulted Rosemary and he wanted him to fight, but that conductor could have made trouble. And believe me, I had an awful time smoothing it over.
With every detail imagined, with even envy for the pair's community of misfortune in the vestibule, Dick felt a change taking place within him. Only the image of a third person, even a vanished one, entering into his relation with Rosemary was needed to throw him off his balance and send through him waves of pain, misery, desire, desperation. The vividly pictured hand on Rosemary's cheek, the quicker breath, the white excitement of the event viewed from outside, the inviolable secret warmth within.
Do you mind if I pull down the curtain?
Please do. It's too light in here.
Collis Clay was now speaking about fraternity politics at New Haven, in the same tone, with the same emphasis. Dick had gathered that he was in love with Rosemary in some curious way Dick could not have understood. The affair with Hillis seemed to have made no emotional impression on Collis, save to give him the joyful conviction that Rosemary was human.
"Bone's got a wonderful crowd,"
he said.
"We all did, as a matter of fact. New Haven's so big now, the sad thing is the men we have to leave out. Do you mind if I pull down the curtain?"
"Please do. It's too light in here."
Dick went over Paris to his bank. Writing a check, he looked along the row of men at the desks, deciding to which one he would present it for an okay. As he wrote, he engrossed himself in the material act, examining meticulously the pen, writing laboriously upon the high glass-top desk. Once he raised glazed eyes to look toward the mail department, then glazed his spirit again by concentration upon the objects he dealt with. Still, he failed to decide to whom the check should be presented. Which man in the line would guess least of the unhappy predicament in which he found himself? And, also, which one would be least likely to talk? There was Perrin, the suave New Yorker who had asked him to luncheons at the American Club. There was Casasus, the Spaniard, with whom he usually discussed a mutual friend, in spite of the fact that the friend had passed out of his life a dozen years before. There was Mukhausa, who always asked him whether he wanted to draw upon his wife's money or his own. As he entered the amount on the stub and drew two lines under it, he decided to go to Pierce, who was young and for whom he would have to put on only a small show. It was often easier to give a show than to watch one. He went to the mail desk first, as the woman who served him pushed up with her bosom a piece of paper that had nearly escaped the desk. He thought how differently women use their bodies from men. He took his letters aside to open. There was a bill for 17 psychiatric books from a German concern, a bill from Brentano's, a letter from Buffalo from his father, in a handwriting that year by year became more indecipherable. There was a card from Tommy Barbon, postmarked Fez, and bearing a facetious communication. There were letters from doctors in Zurich, both in German. A disputed bill from a plasterer in Cannes, a bill from a furniture maker, a letter from the publisher of a medical journal in Baltimore, miscellaneous announcements, and an invitation to a showing of pictures by an incipient artist. Also, there were three letters for Nicole, and a letter for Rosemary sent in his care.
"Do you mind if I pull down the curtain?"
He went toward Pierce, but he was engaged with a woman. And Dick saw with his heels that he would have to present his check to Casasus at the next desk, who was free.
"How are you, Diver?"
Casasus was genial. He stood up, his mustache spreading with his smile.
"We were talking about Featherstone the other day, and I thought of you. He's out in California now."
Dick widened his eyes and bent forward a little.
"In California? That's what I heard."
Dick held the check poised. To focus the attention of Casasus upon it, he looked toward Pierce's desk, holding the latter for a moment in a friendly eye-play condition by an old joke of 3 years before, when Pierce had been involved with a Lithuanian countess. Pierce played up with a grin until Casasus had authorized the check and had no further recourse to detain Dick, whom he liked, than to stand up holding his pince-nez and repeat,
"Yes, he's in California."
Meanwhile, Dick had seen that Perrin, at the head of the line of desks, was in conversation with the heavyweight champion of the world. From a side sweep of Perrin's eye, Dick saw that he was considering calling him over and introducing him, but that he finally decided against it. Cutting across the social mood of Casasus with the intensity he had accumulated at the glass desk, which is to say he looked hard at the check, studying it, and then fixed his eyes on grave problems beyond the first marble pillar to the right of the banker's head, and made a business of shifting the cane, hat, and letters he carried. He said goodbye and went out. He had long ago purchased the doorman. His taxi sprang to the curb.
"I want to go to the film's par excellence studio. It's on a little street in Passy. Go to the Mouette. I'll direct you from there."
He was rendered so uncertain by the events of the last 48 hours that he was not even sure of what he wanted to do. He paid off the taxi at the Mouette and walked in the direction of the studio, crossing to the opposite side of the street before he came to the building. Dignified in his fine clothes, with their fine accessories, he was yet swayed and driven as an animal. Dignity could come only with an overthrowing of his past, of the effort of the last 6 years. He went briskly around the block with the fatuousness of one of Tarkington's adolescents, hurrying at the blind places lest he miss Rosemary's coming out of the studio. It was a melancholy neighborhood. Next door to the place, he saw a sign, 1,000 chemises. The shirts filled the window, piled, cravatted, stuffed, or draped with shoddy grace on the showcase floor. 1,000 chemises. Count them. On either side, he read, "Papeterie, patisserie, sold, réclame," and Constance Talmadge in "Déjeuner de soleil." And farther away, there were more somber announcements. "Vêtements ecclésiastiques, déclaration de décès," and "Pompe funèbre." Life and death. He knew that what he was now doing marked a turning point in his life. It was out of line with everything that had preceded it, even out of line with what effect he might hope to produce upon Rosemary. Rosemary saw him always as a model of correctness. His presence walking around this block was an intrusion. But Dick's necessity of behaving as he did was a projection of some submerged reality. He was compelled to walk there or stand there, his shirt sleeve fitting his wrist and his coat sleeve encasing his shirt sleeve like a sleeve valve, his collar molded plastically to his neck, his red hair cut exactly, his hand holding his small briefcase like a dandy, just as another man once found it necessary to stand in front of a church in Ferrara, in sackcloth and ashes. Dick was paying some tribute to things unforgotten, unshriven, unexpurgated. Chapter 21. After 3/4 of an hour of standing around, he became suddenly involved in a human contact. It was just the sort of thing that was likely to happen to him when he was in the mood of not wanting to see anyone. So rigidly did he sometimes guard his exposed self-consciousness that frequently he defeated his own purposes. As an actor who underplays a part sets up a craning forward, a stimulated emotional attention in an audience, and seems to create in others an ability to bridge the gap he has left open. Similarly, we are seldom sorry for those who need and crave our pity. We reserve this for those who, by other means, make us exercise the abstract function of pity. So Dick might himself have analyzed the incident that ensued. As he paced the Rue des Saint-Ange, he was spoken to by a thin-faced American, perhaps 30, with an air of being scarred and a slight but sinister smile. As Dick gave him the light he requested, he placed him as one of a type of which he had been conscious since early youth, a type that loafed about tobacco stores with one elbow on the counter and watched, through heaven knew what small chink of the mind, the people who came in and out. intimate to garages, where he had vague business conducted in undertones, to barber shops, to the lobbies of theaters. In such places, at any rate, Dick placed him. Sometimes the face bobbed up in one of Tad's more savage cartoons. In boyhood, Dick had often thrown an uneasy glance at the dim borderland of crime on which he stood.
How do you like Paris, buddy?
Not waiting for an answer, the man tried to fit in his footsteps with Dick's.
Where are you from?
He asked encouragingly.
From Buffalo. I'm from San Antone, but I've been over here since the war. You in the army? I'll say I was. 84th Division. Never heard of that outfit?
The man walked a little ahead of him and fixed him with eyes that were practically menacing.
Staying in Paris a while, buddy? Or just passing through?
Passing through.
What hotel you staying at?
Dick had begun laughing to himself. The party had the intention of rifling his room that night. His thoughts were read, apparently, without self-consciousness.
With a build like yours, you oughtn't to be afraid of me, buddy. There's a lot of bums around just laying for American tourists. But you needn't be afraid of me.
Becoming bored, Dick stopped walking.
I just wonder why you've got so much time to waste. Well, I'm in business here in Paris. In what line? Selling papers.
The contrast between the formidable manner and the mild profession was absurd. But the man amended it with,
Don't worry, I made plenty money last year. 10 or 20 francs for a sunny times that cost 6.
He produced a newspaper clipping from a rusty wallet and passed it over to one who had become a fellow stroller. The cartoon showed a stream of Americans pouring from the gangplank of a liner freighted with gold.
200,000. Spending 10 million a summer.
What are you doing out here in Passy?
His companion looked around cautiously.
Movies, he said darkly. They got an American studio over there, and they need guys can speak English. I'm waiting for a break.
Dick shook him off quickly and firmly. It had become apparent that Rosemary either had escaped on one of his early circuits of the block or else had left before he came into the neighborhood. He went into the bistro on the corner, bought a lead disc, and squeezed in an alcove between the kitchen and the foul toilet he called the Hois-Jarge. He recognized Chain Stokes' tendencies in his respiration. But like everything, the symptom served only to turn him in toward his emotion. He gave the number of the hotel, then stood holding the phone and staring into the cafe. After a long while, a strange little voice said hello.
This is Dick. I had to call you.
A pause from her. Then, bravely and in key with his emotion, I'm glad you did.
I came to meet you at your studio. I'm out in Passy across the way from it. I thought maybe we'd ride around through the bois.
Oh, I only stayed there a minute. I'm so sorry. A silence.
Rosemary.
Yes, Dick?
Look, I'm in an extraordinary condition about you. When a child can disturb a middle-aged gent, things get difficult.
You're not middle-aged, Dick. You're the youngest person in the world.
Rosemary?
Silence while he stared at a shelf that held the humbler poisons of France. Bottles of Otar, Rum St. James, Marie Brizard, Punch Orangeade, André Fernet Blanco, Cherry Rocher, and Armagnac.
Are you alone? Do you mind if I pull down the curtain?
Who do you think I'd be with?
That's the state I'm in. I'd like to be with you now.
Silence, then a sigh and an answer. I wish you were with me now. There was the hotel room where she lay behind a telephone number, and little gusts of music wailed around her. And two for tea, and me for you, and you for me. Alone. There was the remembered dust of powder over her tan. When he kissed her face, it was damp around the corners of her hair.
There was the flash of a white face under his own, the arc of a shoulder.
It's impossible,
he said to himself. In a minute he was out in the street marching along toward the Mouette, or away from it, his small briefcase still in his hand, his gold-headed stick held at a sword-like angle. Rosemary returned to her desk and finished a letter to her mother.
I only saw him for a little while, but I thought he was wonderful-looking. I fell in love with him. Of course, I do love Dick best, but you know what I mean. He really is going to direct the picture and is leaving immediately for Hollywood, and I think we ought to leave, too. Collis Clay has been here. I like him all right, but have not seen much of him because of the divers, who really are divine, about the nicest people I ever knew. I am feeling not very well today, and am taking the medicine, though see no need for it. I'm not even going to try to tell you all that's happened until I see you. So when you get this letter, wire, wire, wire. Are you coming north, or shall I come south with the divers?
At 6, Dick called Nicole.
Have you any special plans? He asked. Would you like to do something quiet? Dinner at the hotel and then a play?
Would you? I'll do whatever you want. I phoned Rosemary a while ago, and she's having dinner in her room. I think this upset all of us, don't you?
It didn't upset me,
he objected.
Darling, unless you're physically tired, let's do something. Otherwise, we'll get south and spend a week wondering why we didn't see Boucher. It's better than brooding.
This was a blunder, and Nicole took him up sharply. Brooding about what?
About Maria Wallace.
She agreed to go to a play. It was a tradition between them that they should never be too tired for anything, and they found it made the days better on the whole and put the evenings more in order. When, inevitably, their spirits flagged, they shifted the blame to the weariness and fatigue of others. Before they went out, as fine-looking a couple as could be found in Paris, they knocked softly at Rosemary's door. There was no answer. Judging that she was asleep, they walked into a warm, strident Paris night, snatching a vermouth and bitters in the shadow by Fouquet's bar. Chapter 22 Nicole awoke late, murmuring something back into her dream before she parted her long lashes tangled with sleep. Dick's bed was empty. Only after a minute did she realize that she had been awakened by a knock at their salon door.
Entrez!
She called. But there was no answer. And after a moment she slipped on a dressing gown and went to open it. A sergeant de ville confronted her courteously and stepped inside the door.
Mr. Afghan North. He is here.
What? No. He's gone to America.
When did he leave, madame?
Yesterday morning. He shook his head and waved his forefinger at her in a quicker rhythm.
He was in Paris last night. He is registered here, but his room is not occupied. They told me I had better ask at this room.
Sounds very peculiar to me. We saw him off yesterday morning on the boat train.
Be that as it may, he has been seen here this morning. Even his carte d'identité has been seen. And there you are.
We know nothing about it, she proclaimed in amazement. He considered. He was an ill-smelling, handsome man.
You were not with him at all last night?
But no.
We have arrested a Negro. We are convinced we have at last arrested the correct Negro.
I assure you that I haven't an idea what you're talking about. If it's the Mr. Abraham North, the one we know, well, if he was in Paris last night, we weren't aware of it. The man nodded, sucked his upper lip, convinced but disappointed.
What happened?
Nicole demanded. He showed his palms, puffing out his closed mouth. He had begun to find her attractive, and his eyes flickered at her.
What do you wish, madame? A summer affair. Mr. Afghan North was robbed, and he made a complaint. We have arrested the miscreant. Mr. Afghan should come to identify him and make the proper charges.
Nicole pulled her dressing gown closer around her and dismissed him briskly. Mystified, she took a bath and dressed. By this time it was after 10, and she called Rosemary but got no answer. Then she phoned the hotel office and found that Abe had indeed registered at 6:30 this morning. His room, however, was still unoccupied. Hoping for a word from Dick, she waited in the parlor of the suite. Just as she had given up and decided to go out, the office called and announced,
Mr. Groschot a nègre.
On what business? She demanded.
He says he knows you and the doctor. He says there is a Mr. Freeman into prison that is a friend of all the world. He says there is injustice and he wishes to see Mr. North before he himself is arrested.
We know nothing about it. Nicole disclaimed the whole business with a vehement clap of the receiver. Abe's bizarre reappearance made it plain to her how fatigued she was with his dissipation. Dismissing him from her mind, she went out, ran into Rosemary at the dressmaker's, and shopped with her for artificial flowers and all colored strings of colored beads on the Rue de Rivoli. She helped Rosemary choose a diamond for her mother, and some scarves and novel cigarette cases to take home to business associates in California. For her son, she bought Greek and Roman soldiers, a whole army of them, costing over 1,000 francs. Once again, they spent their money in different ways, and again, Rosemary admired Nicole's method of spending. Nicole was sure that the money she spent was hers. Rosemary still thought her money was miraculously lent to her, and she must consequently be very careful of it. It was fun spending money in the sunlight of the foreign city, with healthy bodies under them that sent streams of color up to their faces, with arms and hands, legs and ankles that they stretched out confidently, reaching or stepping with the confidence of women lovely to men. When they got back to the hotel and found Dick, all bright and new in the morning, both of them had a moment of complete childish joy. He had just received a garbled telephone call from Abe, who, so it appeared, had spent the forenoon in hiding. It was one of the most extraordinary telephone conversations I've ever held. Dick had talked not only to Abe, but to a dozen others. On the phone, these supernumeraries had been typically introduced as,
"Man wants to talk to you, he's in the teapot dome. Well, he says he was in it. What is it? Hey, somebody, shut up. Anyhow, he was in some scandal. He can't possibly go home. My own personal is that my personal is he's had a..."
Gulps sounded, and thereafter what the party had rested with the unknown. The phone yielded up a supplementary offer.
"I thought it would appeal to you anyhow as a psychologist."
The vague personality who corresponded to this statement was eventually hung on to the phone. In the sequence, he failed to appeal to Dick as a psychologist, or indeed as anything else. Abe's conversation flowed on as follows.
"Hello? Well? Well, hello.
Who are you?"
"Well..."
There were interpolated snorts of laughter.
"Well, I'll put somebody else on the line."
Sometimes Dick could hear Abe's voice, accompanied by scufflings, droppings of the receiver, faraway fragments such as,
"No, I don't, Mr. North."
Then a pert, decided voice had said, "If you are a friend of Mr. North, you will come down and take him away." Abe cut in, solemn and ponderous, beating it all down with an overtone of earthbound determination.
"Dick, I've launched a race riot in Montmartre. I'm going over and get Freeman out of jail. If a Negro from Copenhagen that makes shoe poly- Hello? Can you hear me? Well, look, if anybody comes there..."
Once again, the receiver was a chorus of innumerable melodies. "Why are you back in Paris?" Dick demanded.
"I got as far as ever, and I decided to take a plane back so I could compare it with Saint-Sulpice.
I mean, I don't intend to bring Saint-Sulpice back to Paris. I don't even mean broke. I meant Saint-Germain. Oh, for God's sake. Wait a minute. I'll put the chasseur on the wire.
For God's sake, don't.
Listen, did Mary get off all right?
Yes.
Dick, I want you to talk with the man I met here this morning. The son of a naval officer that's been to every doctor in Europe. Let me tell you about him.
Dick had rung off at this point. Perhaps that was a piece of ingratitude, for he needed grist for the grinding activity of his mind. Abe used to be so nice, Nicole told Rosemary. So nice. Long ago, when Dick and I were first married. If you had known him then, he'd come to stay with us for weeks and weeks, and we scarcely knew he was in the house. Sometimes he'd play. Sometimes he'd be in the library with a muted piano, making love to it by the hour.
Dick, do you remember that maid? She thought he was a ghost, and sometimes Abe used to meet her in the hall and moo at her, and it cost us a whole tea service once. But we didn't care.
So much fun, so long ago. Rosemary envied them their fun, imagining a life of leisure unlike her own. She knew little of leisure, but she had the respect for it of those who have never had it. She thought of it as a resting, without realizing that the divers were as far from relaxing as she was herself.
What did this to him? She asked. Why does he have to drink?
Nicole shook her head right and left, disclaiming responsibility for the matter.
So many smart men go to pieces nowadays.
And when haven't they?
Dick asked.
Smart men play close to the line because they have to. Some of them can't stand it, so they quit.
It must lie deeper than that. Nicole clung to her conversation. Also, she was irritated that Dick should contradict her before Rosemary.
Artists like, well, like Fernand, don't seem to have to wallow in alcohol.
Why is it just Americans who dissipate? There were so many answers to this question that Dick decided to leave it in the air, to buzz victoriously in Nicole's ears. He had become intensely critical of her. Though he thought she was the most attractive human creature he had ever seen, though he got from her everything he needed, he scented battle from afar. And subconsciously he had been hardening and arming himself, hour by hour. He was not given to self-indulgence, and he felt comparatively graceless at this moment of indulging himself, blinding his eyes with the hope that Nicole guessed at only an emotional excitement about Rosemary. He was not sure. Last night at the theater, she had referred pointedly to Rosemary as a child. The trio lunched downstairs in an atmosphere of carpets and padded waiters, who did not march at the stomping quickstep of those men who brought good food to the tables whereon they had recently dined. Here there were families of Americans staring around at families of Americans, and trying to make conversation with one another. There was a party at the next table that they could not account for. It consisted of an expansive, somewhat secretarial, would-you-mind-repeating young man and a score of women. The women were neither young nor old nor of any particular social class. Yet the party gave the impression of a unit, held more closely together, for example, than a group of wives stalling through a professional congress of their husbands. Certainly it was more of a unit than any conceivable tourist party. An instinct made Dick suck back the grave derision that formed on his tongue. He asked the waiter to find out who they were.
"Those are the Gold Star Mousers,"
explained the waiter. Aloud and in low voices, they exclaimed. Rosemary's eyes filled with tears.
"Probably the young ones are the wives," said Nicole.
Over his wine, Dick looked at them again, and their happy faces, the dignity that surrounded and pervaded the party. He perceived all the maturity of an older America. For a while, the sobered women who had come to mourn for their dead, for something they could not repair, made the room beautiful. Momentarily, he sat again on his father's knee, riding with Mosby while the old loyalties and devotions fought on around him. Almost with an effort, he turned back to his two women at the table and faced the whole new world in which he believed.
"Do you mind if I pull down the curtain?"
Chapter 23. Abe North was still in the Ritz bar, where he had been since 9 in the morning. When he arrived, seeking sanctuary, the windows were open and great beams were busy at pulling up the dust from smoky carpets and cushions. Chasseurs tore